This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, thanks for joining me for Rear Vision. I'm Keri Phillips, pleased to bring you a colourful slice of Australian political history, thanks to the return of one of its most controversial characters.
Look who's back.
If I thought it was something that I expected to happen, I would have brought my hat.
Barnaby Joyce barnstorming his way back into the Nationals' top job. A man who, by his own admission, is far from perfect.
I acknowledge my faults and I resigned, as I should and I did.
A remarkable resurrection more than 3 years after his dual citizenship and then his dignity were stripped from him.
I failed.
The party he leads is the second oldest in Australia. Only the Labor Party has been around longer. Now formally known as the National Party of Australia, more often just the Nats, the party's roots go back to the 19th century. And it celebrated a great landmark, 100 years of representation in federal parliament just last year. No other Western country in the world has a political party like it, and its longevity is a testament in part to how we Australians, as a largely urban nation, regard the people who live on the land. In this Rear Vision, we'll hear the story of the Nats, a party that started out as the Country Party, having grown out of the different farmers' groups that sprang up around Australia in the 19th century. Professor Frank Bongiorno is a historian at the ANU.
So the Country Party really emerged around the time of the First World War, and it generally was based on organisations such as the Farmers and Settlers Association in New South Wales, a Graziers Association, which tended to represent larger farmers. So it was very much an alliance of different kinds of rural enterprise, both small and larger farmers. And in many respects, the Country Party represents a kind of reconciliation of classes that had actually been in conflict for much of the 19th century, really over the control of land. You know, that great conflict in the 19th century between squatters and selectors, pastoralists and farmers. By the time you get towards the end of the 19th century, that kind of conflict had largely been resolved. And that was a precondition, really, for an organisation like the Country Party coming into being, because it represented, in slightly different ways in different places, an alliance of smaller and larger farmers.
Gabriel Chan is the author of Rusted Off, Why Country Australia is Fed Up.
Right from the very beginning, there was this tension that we still see now in the National Party over whether they should be coalitionist, as in joining together with other parties to be the party of government or try and be the party of government, or whether they should be more in the independent mould, which was really tweaking and knocking the corners off other parties' policies in order to get some influence and get policy that better represented farmers in their view.
Although this debate continues today, the Country Party, once it had seats in the federal parliament in 1920, very quickly formed a coalition with the Nationalists, the forerunner of the Liberal Party, united in their opposition to organised labour. Professor Linda Bottrell is one of the editors of an excellent history called The National Party.
The common feature that has underpinned the coalition relationship for a very long time has been its opposition to organised labour. So for the Country Party and then later the National Party, the origins of that go back to the shearers' strikes of the 1890s. Of course, obviously, as the party of capitalism, the Liberals have also been uncomfortable with organised labour having too much power. So in many ways, that's the common thread that has gone through the coalition relationship. The federal coalition started around 1921, I think, and their original statement in Parliament was that they weren't going to align themselves with either side of politics. And they originally carved out their niche as being the voice of the country, whereas the other two major forces in politics were seen as representing urban Australia. But obviously that commitment to stay out of coalition didn't last very long.
The idea that the Country Party should stand up for rural Australia was linked to a concept that the political scientist Don Aitken called country-mindedness. This is the idea that those on the land and their noble struggle against nature underpinned Australia's prosperity and indeed our national character.
This is a fascinating area, the strength of country-mindedness slash agrarian sentiment in Australia, given that we are such an urbanised country. So agrarian sentiment is actually something that Australia has in common with many Western countries. So there's a couple of different components to this. One is a very foundationalist idea, which people will instinctively respond to, which is that food and fibre are the basis of our economy, that farmers provide us with the food that we eat and they provide us with fibre. So that idea that the economy is based on farming. And we've seen it in Australia, and of course for decades we did actually ride on the sheep's back. So it was a good reflection of the state of the Australian economy and the debt that we owed the farming sector. The agrarian myth, or the romanticised myth of farming, is deeply held right across Australian culture. So it allows the National Party to tap into sympathy that perhaps they wouldn't if they were another part of the community.
Government policies that proved popular with those on the land grew out of the First World War, when the federal government ran programs of compulsory acquisition, essentially taking control of agricultural production. The Country Party and the farmers they represented enjoyed a kind of support and protection during the first half of the 20th century that would disappear in the second. Professor Jeff Cockfield is the co-editor of the National Party.
During the war, in order to coordinate food supply and food management, there was a degree of compulsory acquisition, especially around wheat, and the formation of effectively a forerunner of the Australian Wheat Board. Now, that was largely dismantled. There were some states, including Queensland, that kept going with compulsory acquisition of grain. But that set a blueprint that farmers aspired to, because in having a commodity organisation, particularly a compulsory one, that would give them, by de facto, considerable market power, not as individuals, but collectively. And that was something that farm organisations really rallied around. And initially, in the post-war period, governments were reluctant to go along with that. But after the Second World War, those arrangements were solidified there. So I think that very important step in the First World War with that national management of food.
What did that actually mean for farmers?
So how it was seen to benefit farmers was essentially around increased market power. And if you think of farmers as having three kind of business functions, one is production, which they have a great focus on, and one is the business management, which has always been perhaps a lesser aspect, but very important aspect of farming. And then the third was around kind of marketing product. And effectively, if you have a commodity board or organisation, that function of marketing is largely taken away from you. Silos were built, railways were built to transport grain, and professional marketing managers were put in place who would handle that grain. It didn't keep ongoing nationally after the First World War, but it did keep going in some states to some extent, and particularly most states then developed bulk handling organisations for grain and sugar, so that therefore you had a system in which was centrally managed, and that reduced the costs and uncertainty and perishability of goods. So it was seen as advantage to farmers. But it was also symbolic in the sense of giving farmers a sense that they had market power. And I think that was probably true. You know, obviously, if you aggregate lots of commodity, you do get market power. So that was extremely important development. So that we gave them something to lobby for. And then the big hits that helped revive that were sort of three steps. A bit of commodity crashing in the 1920s. There was a boom period in some of the early 20s, and then commodity prices collapsed, and then leading into a recession was step two, and then leading back into World War II, where again there was national coordination. And by this time, the Country Party was very, very powerful, relatively speaking, and they could really organise around protecting and defending those arrangements and extending them, really.
The Country Party, under leader John McEwen, flourished in the years after World War II, its MPs holding important cabinet positions in the Menzies government. McEwen, as Trade Minister, vigorously supported taxes on imports, opposed by many of his Liberal colleagues, but favoured by those in the country, some of whom now worked in regional manufacturing, protected by these high tariffs.
The period after the Second World War, and particularly from 1950 through to really about 1970, was a golden age for the Country Party. It was in government as part of a coalition with the Liberal Party. Again, Arthur Fadden, who was the Country Party leader, was treasurer through the 1950s. And then in the 1960s, the leader of the Country Party was John McEwen. And McEwen, a Victorian farmer, an ex-soldier settler, was a deeply influential political figure during this period. He was the major figure in the government, apart from Menzies himself. And McEwen was a very strong protectionist. And this is ironic in view of what you might imagine to be the interests of farmers, which is not in high levels of tariff protection. But McEwen argued that protection was necessary for national development. And of course, by the time you get to the 1950s and 1960s, so many country towns in Australia had significant industry which was dependent on tariff protection.
The post-war period is the high point of both Country Party power and also the myriad arrangements around supporting agriculture. You had wheat board, you had a sugar board, cotton board later on, you had compulsory acquisition, you had subsidies for purchasing machinery, you had subsidies for purchasing fertiliser, and essentially what you had was a policy pipeline. So the Country Party was really the pipeline into government. So farm organisations could say, this is what we want, and the Country Party was a means by which that could be conveyed to government. And you built up a whole lot of policy architecture around the protection of agriculture.
This is Radio National's Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. 2 months ago, Barnaby Joyce successfully challenged Michael McCormack to become once again the leader of the National Party, the Nats. This is the story of one of Australia's oldest political parties, an agrarian party that survived against the odds in an overwhelmingly urban nation.
Unlike our competitors in the US and Europe, we don't want to be subsidised to produce and then subsidised to export. We're not after short-term handouts from this or any other government. We haven't got them now, and we don't want them in the future. But we are sick and tired of subsidising the rest of Australia. It's costing us more than $1 billion every year. We want the government to remove taxes on our productive inputs. We want all the taxes taken off fuel. All the taxes taken off fuel. So that we can get down to level terms with those competitors I just mentioned.
During the 1980s, Australia was hit by the neoliberal economic wave that swept through the Western world. Australia's economy was transformed by deregulation, especially under the Hawke-Keating government, which stripped away old forms of protection. That speaker was Ian McLaughlin, president of the National Farmers Federation, addressing a rally of 45,000 farmers who marched through Canberra on the first day of Bob Hawke's tax summit in July 1985. And it wasn't just farmers who were under financial pressure. In the 1950s and 60s, industries established in country towns had blossomed behind Australia's tariff walls, but these would not survive the opening up of Australia's economy.
Well, country towns had many industries. Food processing was a classic example of country town capitalism. Soft drink manufacture would be another. But even things like white goods manufacture often took off in regional centres. So Australia had a booming consumer economy of the 1950s and 60s. And of course, the country towns of Australia were doing very well. But they were very dependent, in many instances at least, on government support.
The deregulation agenda that really began with the Hawke-Keating government, received pretty hard pushback from rural areas. You saw the rationalisation and privatisation of services, and you saw a breaking down of what country people would regard as the contract between metropolitan and rural places and people. But there was this sense, because it was a Labor government conducting the policy reform, there was this sense of holding our collective breaths, if you like, that, oh, maybe on the other side of this, the coalition will ride in and reinstate, restore some of the policy settings. But of course, John Howard and his government and Tim Fisher really doubled down on the deregulation agenda and brought about their own changes in rural areas. And I don't think it's an accident that in the Howard government is when you're starting to see more rural independence pop up. So there's this sense that this isn't the coalition that we remember from pre-Hawke-Keating days. This is a very different coalition. And what is it doing to the pillars that we considered to be the basic tenets of rural policy? And so I think that breakdown of what rural people would see as an agreement between metropolitan and country Australia really starts the breakdown of the National Party's sense of identity.
The method may be unsophisticated, but the Premier, undaunted by criticisms from within the National Party, has begun the march to Canberra in earnest. Policy is vintage Joe. Today at Bethany, the talk was of eliminating the ACTU, the Labor Party and the Democrats, and he said he was not concerned with any effect the Joe movement was having on the coalition.
I said, I'm going to have a big input into politics this time. I've said it for the last 3 years. I've had all this business of working and working and working for other parties who can't perform and who can't win. So I said, on the principle, if you want a job well done, do it yourself, and that's just exactly what I'm doing.
We can't leave the 1980s behind without mentioning one of the most curious episodes in Australian politics, the attempt by Queensland National Party Premier Sir Joe Bjorke-Petersen to become Prime Minister of Australia in 1987.
We're really supporting the myth of Queensland being different here, but it is particularly in relation to the coalition, because the Country Party and then the National Party from the 1920s on was the dominant non-Labor Party in the state. And the Liberals and their forerunners were the minor party. And that was particularly continued through the 1980s. In other states and at the national level, the Country Party was always very clearly a small party relative to the Liberals. But in Queensland, it was different. And I think you had a particular style of party organisation and leadership in the Joe era. One may say a sort of messianic kind of thinking started to take hold. And Joe, of course, was a big anti-socialist, and he was really pushing the idea for many years, from the Whitlam era through to the Hawke era, that the horror of the Labor Party and its socialist leanings needed to be combated. And really, the Federal Liberal Party are just not doing enough for that. What we need is real leadership. And he really got sufficient support within the party in Queensland to run this idea, which was initially Joe for PM, but became Joe for Canberra as the campaign moved on. And then it was sort of watered down and then suddenly abandoned. And of course, many, including John Howard himself, attribute that to the loss of the 1987 election, where the coalition thought they had a very good chance. It split the coalition because essentially it forced the Federal Nationals to at least temporarily split, and it led to Ian Sinclair losing the leadership as well.
Despite their decline in influence since the high water mark of the 1950s and 60s, the Nats remain an important part of the political landscape in Australia, although they are an anomaly when you consider what's happened to the other agrarian parties that emerged elsewhere in the early 20th century.
In the early 20th century, quite a lot of countries had clearly agrarian parties, and particularly, I guess, a good comparator is probably the Nordic countries. You could see them in Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark. They were quite influential. they either die out or they change their identity to some extent. And for example, you know, it's quite telling that in the Nordic countries, they're labelled some version of centre parties, and they do seek to sort of get between, I guess, social democrats on one hand and liberals on the other hand. And they do there take on green things. So they're agrarian, moderate and green. Oh, and regional, of course, I should have mentioned that. So I think the Nationals have retained their agrarian origins, but they are a regional party. Most of their candidates now are not farmers, but are people, you know, who've worked in regional areas in some degree or other and probably have agricultural roots of some sort. But they're a regional party, and they definitely have not taken on green thinking, even though, of course, they would make claim to the idea that, you know, farmers are the original conservationists and so on. You do hear that quite a bit.
And the Nats are an anomaly in another way. They're essentially in a permanent coalition with the Liberal Party. In fact, even on the rare occasions that the Liberals win enough seats to govern alone, they choose to remain in coalition with the Nats.
Absolutely. Because what the National Party does is it allows the non-Labor side of government to capture a whole range of different values and different political perspectives. And it allows them to capture some of the votes on perhaps the slightly more extreme right end of the spectrum, who would probably go elsewhere if the party was just the Liberal Party. So the Nationals allow for a separate identity to attract those different sets of values, but in a sense corrals them into a two-party system. And it served the party very well because, again, as a minor party, it would never have had the level of influence in cabinet that it has as a member of an almost permanent coalition. So from the party's point of view, with only a handful of seats, it gets very key cabinet portfolios.
The coalition is a very, very unusual political arrangement. Hardly ever do you see such a long-term permanent coalition in operation. In multi-party democracies in Europe, what you see is elections are held and then people negotiate around coalitions. But an enduring coalition is extremely unusual, and an enduring coalition in which there are only two parties is extremely unusual as well. The pluses for the Nationals are that you get a seat at the table, and particularly you get the agricultural portfolio and you get the regional development portfolio. And up until, you know, 1980s, you got the trade portfolio as well when in government. And of course, they have been in government quite a bit. So you can see the potential advantages there. The counter to that is they have sold out. They join the Liberals and they've become like Liberals and they give in to the Liberals. That's the kind of critical thing that comes from the bush areas and comes from people who are political opponents or competing minor party candidates will be saying. People who take up portfolios are bound by cabinet solidarity. So once a decision is taken, Nationals ministers either resign or they go along with whatever has been decided. And this contributes to the impression that they are kind of lapdogs of the Liberals. And it's very hard to get credit for holding back the tide as they did in the deregulatory period of the 1980s. They certainly were successful in getting lots and lots of concessions. But if you're farmers and you see your commodity board disappearing or you see your bush services disappearing, your bush post office close and so on, you're not very open to the idea that someone has been defending you stoutly and you're annoyed at the loss of things. And I think that tells against them.
In February 2018, Barnaby Joyce resigned the party leadership in disgrace after acknowledging that he was in a relationship and expecting a child with a former staffer. But after a second challenge to leader Michael McCormack in June this year, he returned as party leader and Australia's Deputy Prime Minister.
So one of the things to understand about the Country Party and the National Party is that they have had the most stable leadership of political parties in Australia, incredibly. Long, long periods of leadership by political giants, really. Earl Page, John McEwen, Doug Anthony and so on. And even though the time frame of leaders has diminished, the leadership transitions have generally been handled quite well. So the Barnaby Joyce turbulence is very unusual for the Nationals and very unusual for them to be so much in the news. Normally, you know, they're a bit of a side note in media. His restoration represents another particular aspect of the National Party. It's very important politically for the Nationals to be seen as fighting the good fight and standing up to the Liberals and standing up for rural areas. And that's what Barnaby represents. He is a master of the populist rhetoric. Sometimes it's quite hard to actually work out what it is he's saying, but the way he speaks, speaks to his audience, the audience that he has.
What are the future for the Nationals? Representation in federal parliament has come back from the low point in the 80s and 90s when it got down to around 12 seats.
They are now back up to what I would consider to be round about their geographic limits at the national level. You know, that's round about the 16 seats, a touch above, 10% of seats. And that they achieve with around about, 6.5-7% of the national vote. But they seem to me to be at their limit. It's very hard to see what additional seats they could win back, with the possible exception of something like Bob Katter's seat, if he ever chose to retire and there was no sort of family successor, for example, to his seat, they could win back Kennedy right up in North Queensland. But at the same time, the seats they still hold in northern New South Wales will be eroded over time by demographic change. So it's very hard to see that they would achieve much.
Its demise has been predicted since 1922. So it's a very brave person who says that the National Party is not going to survive. But I think we're beginning to see more farm groups being outspoken on climate change. We are also beginning to see a lot more connection being made between the National Party and the non-agricultural rural activities, like the coal industry, for example. We've seen some very effective rural independents in the past, and I think we're beginning to see more of that. So I'm not prepared to predict their demise, but I think they're probably facing a few more challenges now than they were several decades ago.
I think it will continue on in some shape or form, but I think unless it starts moving with the times, it's really going to be just a little rump in the parliament. Political parties are very careful about what their membership is. They don't trumpet it. But the Farmers for Climate Action now has 6,000 farmer members and 20,000 supporters of Farmers for Climate Action. Now, that, I would gather, is way more than the National Party membership. I'd be happy to be proven wrong if someone wants to come out and confirm their membership. But that is a significant chunk of support of people who are backing action on climate change in order to make farmers' jobs a little easier and a bit more seamless in terms of the way we knit with global policy. And if the National Party is a fraction of that, well, what does it say for where their original constituency lies? I think that they've got to answer these questions as they move forward. Otherwise, it just becomes a sort of personality rabble.
Gabriel Chan, the author of Rusted Off, Why Country Australia is Fed Up. Thanks to her and my other guests, Linda Bottrell and Jeff Cockfield, the editors of The National Party, Prospects for the Great Survivors, and Frank Bongiorno, head of the History Department at the Australian National University. Isabella Tropiano is the sound engineer for this Rear Vision. Bye from Keri Phillips.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.